Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
To kick off the show today, we have a very special interview with our December Get Lit with All of It book club author, the acclaimed novelist Jonathan Lethem. Now, you know that we partner with the New York Public Library to make it possible for as many of you as possible to download our monthly book. And this month's Get Lit is extra special, the partnership with the library, because the choice is part of a new slate called Roar for New York City. It's a new slate of programming celebrating, supporting, and inspiring New York City and its resilient residents. So we selected Jonathan's 1999 novel, Motherless Brooklyn, which is on the library's list of 125 New York City books we love. So we're excited to dive into the novel based on our social media, so are you. And then Jonathan will be at our live event on January 7th. To find out how to tune in, check out a copy of Motherless Brooklyn. You can head to wnyc.org/getlit. But as I said, this is a special interview because it is a bit of a twofer. Jonathan Lethem also has a new novel out that you should check out. It's called The Arrest. The Arrest is set in a world where gradually and then all at once, technology has stopped working. And I don't just mean Wi-Fi and TV and the radio, like you're listening to right now. I mean cars, motorcycles, guns, conveyor belts, electricity. When everything started to go dark, our protagonist, a Hollywood script doctor, Sandy, he was visiting his sister on her agricultural collective in Maine. Luckily, that happened to be just about the best place he could have landed under the circumstances. The farms help keep the community fed and gives the local towns bargaining power over a more violent group to their south. Sandy, who's called the journeyman throughout the novel, has pretty much settled into his new life as a butcher's assistant and a food delivery guy. That is until his old screenwriting partner, the now ultra-rich Peter Todbaum, rolls into town in a gigantic, armored, functioning vehicle equipped with spy cams and, perhaps most importantly, an espresso machine. Todbaum claims that he has traveled across the country just to reunite with Sandy and his sister Maddie. But what exactly does he want, and how will the sudden presence of a working vehicle disrupt the journeyman's peaceful new existence? The New York Times calls The Arrest inventive, entertaining, and superbly written. You can get your copy now from your local indie bookseller, and we're so happy to have Jonathan Lethem with us. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in novels where there's a huge breakdown of norms and societies, zombie apocalypse, nuclear holocaust, pandemics, why did you want the inciting event to be the breakdown of all technology?
Well, I mean, there's the first thing to say about it is that there's a very definite wish fulfillment element in there, a fantasy of a kind of restoration to a calmer, a more centered way of life. And I like to be upfront about that because the book, you know, in a way, it's like a Trojan horse. There's a dystopia and or post-apocalypse. But riding inside that is a lot of dreaminess about how we might potentially get back to, you know, basics. It's a pastoral hiding inside the dystopia in this case.
That's that fantasy we all have when we go on vacation. You're going to unplug. You're going to throw your phone away.
Yes.
You're not going to check your email.
It's a be careful what you wish for, but also it's a thought experiment in reduction. You know, our world is so overwhelming. And, you know, in this story, I'm really just extending a thought that I think people walk around with all the time, which is, you know, what if I could stop knowing all this stuff? What if the stream left me alone, the data stream? And the characters in the book are, you know, variously equipped for this. Some of them have been living in a kind of pre-arrest pastoral already. And it's true that there are people who live on organic farms or where the Wi-Fi is bad or who don't sign up for all their streaming services because they just don't really care. And they aren't living in the grip of all of this stuff. But my point of view character is someone who was a, you know, total addict. He was complicit with it. He was writing screenplays in Hollywood, and he was also someone who lived his life by remote means at every level.
This event is called The Arrest, and I'd love for you to read a little bit in the book about The Arrest.
Sure. Here goes. This is a kind of a long description of the puzzling feeling that settled over people when it started. How even to say when the arrest began? The question was when it had gained your attention. Plenty flew under the radar. Biodiversity halved? That made an impression, barely. Polar ice and Miami drowned? Terrible, yet also too big to take personally. One day, journeymen noticed reports of a new tick-borne disease. Once you'd been bitten, cow meat made your throat close up. No more American Wagyu tomahawk steak for two, black on the outside, red within. People joked uneasily. Were the new ticks an eco-terrorist hack? On television, someone said that the turning point had been when in 1986, the president had removed the solar panels from the White House. Then again, someone else said the turning point had been when St. Paul's epistle had been delivered to the Romans and ignored. You could debate this kind of thing forever. But not on television. Not any longer. Here, the arrest at last commanded Journeyman's attention. He sat up and noticed the death of screens. They died not all at once, the screens, but in droves, like creatures of the warmed ocean, like those hundreds of manatees washing ashore the same day in Boca Grande, who, just weeks before, Journeyman had found uncompelling and deleted from his feed. He'd unfollowed the manatees. No hard feelings. Television died first. Television contracted a hemorrhagic ailment, Ebola or some other flesh-melting thing. The channels bled. Signals fused across time as well as virtual space. A live Rod Serling Playhouse 90 teleplay broadcast from 1956, sputtering into last agonized life and expiring in the middle of episodes of season two of Big Little Lies. The Vietnam War came back. And family ties, too, until these boiled and melted along with the rest. The Gmail, the texts and swipes and FaceTimes, the tweets and likes, these suffered colony collapse disorder. Each messenger could no longer chart its route to the hive, or returned only to languish in the hive, there to lose interest in its labors, whether worker or drone. All at once, the email quit producing honey. So many other ecologies depended on the pollinations, the goings between of the now fatigued drones and workers. Without them, nothing worked. Air conditioning units stalled. Planes fell from the sky. The honey of emails and texts had been the glue holding the world together, it appeared. Now the smart devices all evidenced wasting disease. They had to be put out to level pasture to let them graze out the last part of their lives. There, they crumpled to their knees. Starved, incapable of grazing.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his new novel, The Arrest. So as an author, when you sit down and you know this is sort of the catalyst for everything in your story, how do you decide how much to give away about The Arrest? Getting into the details, because you keep us guessing quite a bit. We're never really quite sure what happened.
Yeah, you know, one of the central thoughts I had going into this book was that I wasn't interested in a kind of rigorous explanation. My characters aren't scientists, and they're completely cut off from the, you know, global communications flow, and they're reduced to guessing. And one of the things that meant a lot to me about that was that I feel that that's actually a kind of permanent condition. I mean, I don't know how the world I live in got to be the way it is. So why should the characters in a science fiction story always be so adamantly clear on how their world got to be the way it is? It seemed much more interesting to have them sometimes guessing, sometimes talking it over, and other times shrugging and just thinking, well, the problem isn't how we got here. The problem is, you know, what to do today.
So we see a lot through Sandy. And he's referred to as journeyman. That's not always a compliment, especially for someone who's a creative person who thinks they make things. Why this title for him?
Yeah, well, journeyman is a kind of rueful, middle-aged guy who has figured out that he's not going to get the big brass ring. And that's even before the arrest makes the entire world that he's lived in, which is the world of Hollywood screenwriting, completely evaporate in a sort of in one puff. He describes himself as a journeyman, but he also thinks of himself as a middleman. He knows he's more a sidekick or a B-list character in life, someone who has access to things and interesting people, but isn't going to light up the room. And he's resigned to it. He's trying to think about what it is to be on the margins of the big time. And one of the things that he's really conscious of is that he's complicit with a lot of things. He's connected to a lot of things, but he's not overtly responsible for them.
So this guy, Peter Todbaum, shows up, his former writing partner, who is all bluster and big talk, and he's got a big machine, the Blue Streak. And I'm looking at the cover. It's very Buck Rogers looking to me. I'm curious what kind of conversations you had with your cover artists. Was this what you had in mind as you were writing it?
Oh yeah, I love the cover, and I didn't do anything to art direct it. I just let them read the book and make their best guess. And you know, I described the supercar in the pages of the book in a kind of confusing metaphorical way, because it's hard to look at. When Journeyman glances up at it when it rides into their town, he sort of compares it to a whole lot of stuff, but he doesn't have the ability to give you a simple picture of it. So I really liked that the cover artist was forced to kind of visualize their own version. And then it came out looking perfect to me. I decided, okay, that's what it looks like, if you could somehow take a photograph of it. The supercar is a kind of, you know, it's a real device. It's a real science fiction, technological idea that this thing drives across the country and ends up in this small town in Maine. But it's also a kind of super mixed metaphor. It's like it represents all of the stuff that these people thought they'd let go of. It's a weapon, and it's a bomb, and it's a tractor, and it's a digging machine, and it's a storytelling machine, and as you pointed out, it's a giant espresso maker. So it's kind of like it's like the past, the technological past, comes roaring back in the shape of one machine.
You know, you listed all of those things. What qualities did you know you wanted this machine to have so that it could serve the story?
Well, I wanted it to feel like Todbaum is the kind of guy who makes summer tentpole franchise motion pictures. And I wanted this car he rode in to be kind of like one of his productions. You know, what they say about those movies is, well, you know, even when, like, maybe you didn't think it was that greatest story, or it was in the best of taste, or it was that original, you still say, but every dollar was on the screen. And that's sort of who Todbaum is. It's like every dollar of his personality, for better or worse, is on the screen. And the supercar is a super manifestation of him. It's like, you know, if he was asleep and dreaming and he could think up the vehicle he would ride, and then he'd wake up and it would be in his driveway. That's what this car is.
There's some sort of meta-narrative happening as well with a script that Sandy, Journeyman, and Todbaum had been working on for decades, an apocalyptic sci-fi story called Yet Another World. Why is Todbaum so fixated on it?
Well, you know, one of the things that I always felt when I was reading science fiction so avidly as a kid was that the one rule in science fiction stories was that there was no science fiction. And being me, I decided that I wanted to break that rule as many different ways as I could. And, you know, when I wrote the novel, The Fortress of Solitude, I had the characters end up at a science fiction convention at one point. The idea that the kinds of characters that I know and familiar with and identify with actually do, you know, they grew up watching The Twilight Zone and Star Trek, and they maybe would go to the kind of movies that Peter Todbaum makes, even when they don't feel satisfied by them. And so I wanted these guys to be able to think about the world that they were in terms of these stories that are lying around available for use. These, you know, science fiction is a set of operations. It's like thinking tools, and we're all doing it. If you go online and you look at how people are digesting this catastrophic year, there are a lot of nervous jokes about, you know, whose movie are we in? Or, you know, is this, you know, is Stephen King dreaming 2020? Or, you know, this self-consciousness is very real, I think. And so I wanted the characters to have this set of descriptions, not just available to them, but on the tips of their tongues, because they themselves were creators of dystopian stories.
And reading this book in this moment now, it has just another entire layer to it than I don't think you could have even imagined, even you with the big imagination. And part of what's interesting is this idea of having to rethink what our society looks like when you start over again. And there's been a lot of conversations about that this year around policing, around defund the police, about what should be done in institutions, legacy institutions, to make them more equitable. In your book, there is sort of this sense of an alternative form of justice. Community members who found guilty of a crime are sent to live in exile by the Lake of Tiredness, which is still being fed by the community. So what was it you wanted to sort of explore about justice?
Well, right. So the arrest, the title is a kind of double arrest. It's what happened to the world, but it's also, you know, a very traditional ethical problem for anyone fantasizing about a more anarchistic, you know, mutual aid based society is, what do you do with a sociopath? Who's going to deal with the person who moves into your, you know, policeless state of being, your temporary autonomous zone or whatever you're calling it, and will take any advantage and manipulate any opportunity? How do you deputize, or who authorizes themselves to confront that problem? And so the community in my book has already, before Todd Bowden showed up, had a dry run. They've had one bad actor in their space who had to be, you know, neutralized somehow. And the question of who was to do it and what this person's victims might wish and what everyone could live with, in the prehistory of this community, it's something I think they're still uncomfortable with. They took action and they don't know what they think about it. And before they can finish thinking about it, they get this new opportunity when the supercar arrives.
My guest, Jonathan Lethem, we've been talking about his new novel, The Arrest. Before I let you go, I do want to talk to you about Motherless Brooklyn. We're so excited that you're going to be our Get Lit with All of It book club author. The public library does this great thing where they make it available to anybody who wants to download it. And they have a special sort of series going on, Roar for New York, so that we can celebrate this city and get people excited and inspired again. For folks who want to take part, go to WNYC.org/getlit to find out more. So this book is on their 125 New York City Books We Love. What is something you want readers to pay attention to as they read along with us this month? Is there something about Motherless Brooklyn that you, when you think about it now, so many years later, you think, this is the part I'd like to really clue people into, or if there's some Easter egg somewhere that no one's ever really realized?
That's great. I love this invitation. And first of all, let me just say what a joy this is to be in this situation. It's a book that I wrote when I was a much younger person, but I've never quit loving talking about it. And when it comes alive in a reader's imagination, I remember writing it, and what a special experience that was for me. So I'm really delighted about this. I guess I'll just point you to one quiet pattern of operation in this story, and I think this is true. You'll tell me if I'm wrong, but I think I was very careful to put one sandwich and one joke into every chapter of the book. And of course, in some cases, you know, it's a barely glimpsed joke or sandwich. It's just barely there. In other cases, it's really prominent. And in some cases, it's a debatable sandwich, like a hot dog or something. But anyway, so look for the sandwich and look for the joke. That's my advice.
That is random and hilarious. I cannot wait to dig back in. We will see you on January 7th for Get Lit with All of It. We'll be discussing Motherless Brooklyn. My guest has been Jonathan Lethem. His new novel is called The Arrest. Jonathan, we'll see you in 2021.
Thanks so much.